All right, we're rolling. So, are we going to do Moneyball on a hot mic again to start off, or?
I got it. Is it me? Well, at least you said we wanted to start off with 100K, and I'm Bitcoin. I'm happy that it actually is above 100K again.
Who is it? I didn't even realize that.
Someone invited me to a 100K party last night. I'm like, it's not 100K. So I didn't go.
It's 98 bullshit.
Well, we're not a price-oriented show anyway, but despite not being price lookers, you can't avoid the fact that the 100K happened. Yeah, what was it? I think 10, 11 years ago, people were saying, if it ever passes 100K in my lifetime, and here we are, 11 years later after that particular tweet I'd shared happened. Anyway, I think we're here. It's both meaningful and meaningless in that it'll probably bounce around up and down, and who knows.
It definitely is meaningful. So even like
Okay.
in my job, my day-to-day job, the price doesn't matter, like what I'm working on, what my team's working on. But the price absolutely matters overall because it's a very good proxy for adoption and importance to the world. And yes, it goes up and down, but if you zoom out to like 4 year or a big moving average, like 200-day moving average or something, or like a 4 year view, it is up and to the right. And if it's down and to the right, then that is a bad sign for Bitcoin because it suggests people are losing faith in it. That would suggest it's becoming less impactful to the world from an economic phenomenon and a money phenomenon. So the price definitely matters. But I think what you meant, David, is like, yeah. For a lot of us building Bitcoin, working on Bitcoin, whether it's, if it bounces down to CK this weekend, we just wake up Monday and keep doing what we're going to do anyway.
I do think it's important, though, to reflect, as you said. One, I think it's important to take moments to celebrate in the sense that, yeah, it's going to be back to work soon. And I've already seen people calling it 0.1 mil, and I think that's great. And it's all true. The first 100K is the hardest. We're going to go to a mil probably faster than a lot of people realize, although who knows. But at the end of the day, I think, one, it's important to just recognize, like, it's come a long way. And like, it's always good to stop and celebrate. I'm always reminded, actually, Steve, and we were all hanging out, you took a stealth photo recently. And so it's good to have, photos from the early days. It's good to pause and reflect and say, the ride is not always what's next, but we've come a long way. So I think that's important. But I think the other thing is, to your point, the number go up technology, we can ourselves have many reasons to like Bitcoin, including, things around self-sovereignty and privacy and all the beautiful things that come with this new monetary system. But at the end of the day, Satoshi was a realist. And the reality is, what gets most people in at first is number go up. And so, to your point, it's not only a good adoption or a proxy for adoption, but in my view, it's the most important thing if you want this to go mainstream. If you want this to be just the realm of the cypherpunks or something like PGP, that's fine. But if you want 8 billion humans and however many trillion, agents one day using this, number needs to go up, and it is.
Yeah. Okay. So I am not in disagreement with any of that. I was kind of poo-pooing it because I think people who make price predictions and tell you, oh, it's going to go up, it's going to go down, it's going to go sideways, is kind of like nonsense. Like, nobody, no matter how smart you think you are, nobody actually knows what's going to happen next. And so I'm just sort of the mindset, like, okay, 100, it's a nice mark, but I wouldn't guarantee you it's going up, and I wouldn't guarantee you it's going down from here or what it's doing next. It's always like unpredictable on a short term. And then a long term, I think it will definitely go up.
With that said, what's your price prediction, David?
150K by Christmas. Let's go. It is funny, I guess, the how as you kind of cross a new order of magnitude, the previous order of magnitude stuff gets kind of contained within it. So the stuff that used to be really exciting for people, like maybe when you cross the 10K wall or the 1K wall, those now happen within a day, like intraday trading, kind of you're up and down by those amounts. So sort of someday people will look back at the 100Ks and be like, that was a big moment when it crossed 100K. They're like, yeah, but we just lost 200K today, or we're up 500K today. And sort of that, at some point, this milestone will also seem kind of irrelevant and small, which is kind of how I like to think of it, because it's my best way to zoom out, as you're saying, and think about how, like, it's meaningful today and won't be meaningful in the future. So kind of, have a little celebration, go out, have yourself a nice steak dinner, whatever you like to do as a Bitcoiner.
I also have two thoughts around the price and predicting this is all going. One is, if Elon is right and the universe goes towards the most, let's say, funny or ridiculous thing, then the last time we were at 69, so next year it's got to be 420K. It's just like it's so it was written. The other thing that I would say though is you guys have heard me talk about this before. Honestly, as much as price is interesting to me, that seems like day-to-day kind of a random walk. However, there is a number that I do track quite closely, which I didn't drop in our chat, but you've heard me talk about this before. And that is from a hedge fund called Capriol Investments. I've been following this guy very closely. He talks about basically he, like many other people that I really respect, see Bitcoin as energy-backed money. And if you see it that way, then you can track the production cost of Bitcoin in joules. So you can just literally say, what is the fair market value of Bitcoin today? No, like future, you know, adoption multipliers or anything like that. What is the fair value today? Price purely in kilowatt hours. Now you have to make some assumptions around that, but assuming you get, you know, roughly right on for cost of average cost of energy, that sort of thing, then his energy value today is at 105, basically $106,000. So to me, that's what I always look at is what's the fair price of Bitcoin is the cost of production. And so I think we're still priced under cost of production.
Yeah. And one other thing that I think is notable about the crossing, because you're making me go there, so we're going to go there. One thing that's
Awesome.
notable is I think each like an order of magnitude has a psychological kind of anchor for some people. Like maybe they got in at 50 and they want to get out at 100. Maybe they got in at 200 and they want to get out at 100K. And so, you know, regardless of when they bought, some people have this idea that they want to get back into USD and fiat at some point. And often when they do that, they pick a number. And so, you know, instead of picking K, they pick 100K because it's kind of easy. You know, we sort of talk in those types of numbers frequently, you know, kind of orders of magnitude and powers of 10. And so I think if I understand right, the order book of like a sell wall at 100K was very, very substantial and took a lot of buying to eat through that wall and kind of decrease it to, you know, to be able to be crossed. Now that it's been crossed, my guess is a lot of that stuff where people had standing orders set trying to sell Bitcoin at 100K is now breached. That's all kind of been consumed. It might have been accruing for 10 years. Who knows? Now that's sort of been eaten. So now it's more flexible to move up and down as needed.
Yeah, I agree. That's what. So, and the phenomenon you just discussed is why I think 100K is notable, but it no longer is now. Now I think it's just another number.
Now it's just another number. Yeah. Is there a name for that phenomenon?
DKism.
I saw Vijay Boyapati shared a video of the cell wall at 10K when that was sort of being eaten. And he was asking if anybody had one for the 100K cell wall, because I think he hadn't captured a similar video if you're looking at like a deep order book. So anyway, onward, shall we? I know we've been collecting up a bunch of things we wanted to talk about. And we have like way too much, and we kind of got started a little bit late, and now we've spent the first 10 minutes or so talking Bitcoin price. So should we move on to Powell calling Bitcoin digital gold?
Yeah.
So there was this tweet actually from Vijay, who we just quoted. He said Jeremy Powell calling Bitcoin digital gold is the biggest endorsement of Bitcoin yet.
Jerome Powell.
Sorry.
I like Jeremy.
Jeremy, he's kind of on first name friendly basis with him.
I didn't
It's a
realize you knew
nickname,
him
Steve.
as well.
I think Vijay and Jerome, it's like a childhood friendship. And, you know, he used to call him Jeremy because his mother did. But if you understand where financial power lies, he said bigger than Fink or even Trump. So, and I think Steve, you had some commentary on that. Why is that such a big deal? I wouldn't have guessed it bigger than Fink or Trump.
Well, a few other folks I know said that. I didn't really react that way, but I did hear two reactions. What one was like, this is one of the biggest statements or moments in the history of Bitcoin, which kind of surprised me, maybe you as well. But I also heard like he didn't like frame it correctly, or he doesn't seem to understand Bitcoin well or something. But that seems strange to me. I mean, having him say anything about Bitcoin or showing any semblance of appreciation for what it is or could be seems like quite notable to me. So him saying that it is similar or equivalent to gold, like a digital gold, that is a big step forward. And like maybe for us, it's like who cares what he thinks? But there's a lot of people who are not yet in the Bitcoin ecosystem where a Donald Trump or a Larry Fink or a Jerome Powell even showing giving it any sign of credibility is important. So I think it helps win over new people.
I also think it's really important what he compared it to versus not. So comparing it to digital gold is great, but I think the bigger story in my mind is that he says it doesn't compete with the US dollar, which in my mind, it's interesting because, you know, I don't know if he believes that. Of course, that's what you have to say if you're, you know, you're guarding the US dollar, so to speak. But it seems to me like if I were just guessing and heard this on face value, like a move one would take if one were about to establish a strategic Bitcoin reserve for the United States and did not want the rest of the world and your own country to freak out that you're abandoning the dollar. So if one were playing the slow sort of drip long game of how do we, kind of like change the engine mid-flight and have the soft landing from being the dominant global reserve currency into Bitcoin without causing everyone to FOMO and think that our currency days of domination are over, seems like a big step.
But does Jerome Powell have an incentive to kind of talk about it as non-money because it gives him more power to do the reserve? Like if it were money, would he not have sort of lessen his ability to do that?
Well, imagine just for a second. I mean, I have no insider info. I don't even know how all of the relationship works between the reserve chair and Trump and whoever is established, Treasury or other established strategic reserve. Maybe you guys have better options than that. But if I'm looking at it purely from the outside and I know that if this competes with the dollar and I endorse this versus the dollar, that is a pretty fucking big knock on the dollar. And it seems like I'm no longer supporting my country's currency. Whereas if I say, hey, the dollar has been dominant for the last almost whatever, going on a century, and during that time, we've still had strategic gold reserves and it never challenged the dollar, then that seems like a big move to be able to give you cover to do it.
Right. I'm reminded of this. Have you heard this? I think there's a famous Peter Thiel quote that says something like, a company that actually has monopoly spends all this time trying to convince you that it doesn't have a monopoly. And a startup that actually has no moat or at all, anything, is spending all their time trying to convince you that they are a monopoly. And I think about that with respect to kind of like the digital gold, digital property versus the money story of Bitcoin. I think they kind of have a similar thing. When people are telling you about why they think it's really good digital gold and money, they might actually be arguing that they're telling you that it's digital gold and they actually mean that it's really good money. And if they're telling you that it's money, maybe they're actually the opposite. And I think Saylor has backed off any money related narrative if he ever had one. I don't know for sure, but I think he's very like digital property, cyber hornets or whatever. It's like New York City, right? Like digital New York City. Real estate and non-money. But then here's, I guess, Steve, like, I think if my understanding from what I've heard you say in the past is if Bitcoin were not money in the future, didn't have the potential to be money, that you would be uninterested in pursuing work on it. Is that fair? Is that too?
Yeah, and just to be clear, when you say money in this context, you're talking about currency, like a d daily
Yeah,
use.
like p payments of some sort. Yeah.
I mean, because I think some people would say store of value is money as well. Yeah. So me personally, if I didn't believe that Bitcoin can become a currency, then I'd still invest in it as an incredible investment towards future store value appreciation, even at this point, but I wouldn't work on it. For me, working on it, both is for multiple reasons, but one is that I think it already has a product market fit for store of value. So like what would I mean, yes, I could come up with some things I could do, but not a whole lot. Whereas on the currency side, there's a lot of software engineering work, a lot of design work, and a lot of other work that is a little bit more within my control. So I think I can, personally have an impact.
To me, it's just kind of crazy that I think it shows where we are in people's acceptance of Bitcoin. And again, I would be curious if people like Saylor and if people like our buddy Jeremy, if they actually, because to me, it seems very obvious if you just zoom out, 15 years ago, Bitcoin didn't exist. Now we already have rifled through the collectible stage, we've rifled through the store of value. We're doing that as we speak in real time. The next two stages are pretty obvious. And, I get that you kind of have this like in this, and maybe it takes another 10 years, maybe it takes another 15 years, but in the grand scheme of things, that's nothing, right? That's literally the blink of an eye. And so to me, it just seems super inevitable. It's going to go all the way. You kind of have to, either because you don't have willing suspension of disbelief and you're still very stuck in the old world, believe that there's going to be a transition period. And you probably also kind of just have to say that because, like, look, I mean, if you're the United States, you don't want to just like give up the, right? And I don't think that's a smart move either. So you start with, well, we're going to start by backing the dollar a little bit by Bitcoin. That grows over time. And then eventually, you just kind of have like 10% more Lightning payments, which, Steve, I know you're going to talk about this and how we actually get there over time. But in 15 years, I think we'll wake up. Maybe that's too soon. Let's say at least in 30 years, wake up and Bitcoin's what everyone uses for everything. But people are either not going to acknowledge it because they have incentives not to, or they don't actually.
One thing I'd say about the do people have some kind of like hidden agenda when they say it's digital gold and they're really thinking it's currency? I think that there's certainly a segment of people that do that, but I think it's a very tiny segment. Like Michael Saylor might be doing that, But I do not think Jerome Powell is doing that. And I think even a lot of people in Bitcoin aren't doing, I mean, and a lot of people in Bitcoin just view it as digital gold. A lot of people in cryptocurrency. In fact, that's a huge portion of people who focus their time and energy on non-Bitcoin cryptocurrency view Bitcoin as digital gold, period. And they don't think it'll be a future currency. So I think that's the predominant view. And then there's also a group of Bitcoiners who buy into the staging of it needs to become a store of value first, then a currency, then a unit of account. And since we've mentioned Vijay Boyapati a couple times already, we'll give him a shout out on his bullish, what was it, bullish case for Bitcoin. It was a long, like 40-minute Medium post, but he turned it into a book. Excellent read. Everyone should read it. In which he speaks about that. Now, I subscribe to pretty much everything he writes to in that piece, but I wouldn't say it's a waterfall model. Like if you were to graph out adoption of those three phases, it's not like store value goes from 0% to 100%, then medium exchange is 0% to 100%. It's like
Right.
they overlap. So, I mean, that's not even up for debate because people are using Bitcoin today for medium of exchange or using it as a currency. It's very niche today. The volume amounts are very small, but if you look at the data on Lightning, which is right now the predominant technology to do payments on Bitcoin, we are seeing 10 to 15% growth per month. So it's xing every 2 years. We've seen that pattern for 3 years now, and so it's gone from minuscule to tiny. But if we, you know, there's no I see no signs of that slowing down. So if that growth rate continues, which I think is completely realistic at this stage still, then in 4 years, it will have grown from tiny to quite meaningful. And in something like a decade, it can soar past Visa, in which obviously it's quite meaningful then. So, and this can all happen in parallel to Bitcoin being adopted and being viewed as a store of value and going from like speculation of it being a store of value to like, oh no, it is the preeminent store of value in the world. And obviously, we are in the midst of that. I mean, you really have to be cynical to look at Bitcoin and not say that we're right smack in the middle of the adoption phase of Bitcoin as a store of value. So, can it reach $1 million and like really have widespread belief and adoption as store of value in 10 years? For sure. Like, I mean, like, in fact, that seems like the likely case right now.
When you talk about, is it 10 to 15% monthly growth of Lightning transactions? Was that the number?
Yeah.
So do you have any visibility into like what are the most common use cases where it's growing today? Like, I'd say like at least one of two buckets that I'd be interested in. One is like, are they being used where USD might be a good alternative, but people just choose that whether for ideological or convenience reasons or whatever? Or is it cases where like USD just wouldn't make sense because it's machine to machine or some sort of other cryptographic need that just doesn't kind of work with kind of traditional financial rails.
Yeah, I don't have great insight into that. I wish I did. I mean, it's a great question. I don't think it's for Starbucks coffee, which is the canonical case people have talked about for over a decade. I think that's kind of laughable. That seems like the last use case that will be adopted for Bitcoin as a currency is like Americans buying their Starbucks coffee with Bitcoin. So I would suspect like gambling sites would be one that would see early adoption. I would guess like, or actually, here's some. This isn't Lightning, but it is Bitcoin payments. The BTC Pay project, which is an open source project, merchant payment processing, for Bitcoin payments, it's used by, I think it's Namecheap, like one of the DNS, or sorry, is it D or is it VPN or DNS? VPN.
Name for buying domain names.
Yeah, anyway, I don't know. I'm actually forgetting if it's DNS or VPN right now, but whatever it is, they accept Bitcoin payments. And I think they've done like $73 million in volume and it's growing like a weed. But what I was thinking, like VPN is a very clear use case for Bitcoin where you don't want to have like your identity attached to it like you would with a credit card. So that seems like a very natural early adopter use case as well. So yeah, I'd love to see better data on where that growth is coming from, but The data is the sources I'm aware of are real though. Got it. It's not made up data.
Let's pause there actually for a minute. I have some sort of insights on this as well, but Steve, I'm curious because one of the challenges in like even in my own, case trying to tell my own LPs about what's happening in Lightning Network is obviously it's like the Honey Network. It's peer-to-peer routed, which means it has a lot of privacy. So one way I've been able to get some data is from private companies. Some of that's been publicly released. I know River put out a report, I guess, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where they basically surveyed a lot of companies and released that. What data sources are you getting this 10 to 15% growth from in the first place?
The River report was August 2023, so a little over a year ago. It covered 2 years of data, and it was 1,212% growth over 2 years. And their data was pretty expansive. It included many companies in the space, private data. So that's one data source. And then other data sources are just from private companies in the space, including the past year, which gives me strong confidence in continued strong growth rates that were reported in that River report have continued since then.
I mean, a couple of areas that I've seen, haven't still seen in my own research and companies a lot of people using Lightning for things. I think that we've seen some settlement use cases, like between like companies using Lightning for settlement. Some of that is there, and that an international settlement continues to be an area I'm pretty bullish on. I think it's a low percentage of actual volume by quantity or by amount, but certainly by of payments. I think the Nostr apps and use cases for things like Stacker News, that's still, I would guess that is a very large percentage of total payments, but very small percentage of total volume, whereas something like settlement is a very small percentage of payments, but a very large percentage of the actual volume moved. But I expect those use cases to continue to absolutely explode first. I think that both the companies doing Lightning in the background, so with companies like Lightspark, obviously having announced Nubank being on board, like Nubank and Bitso alone, like, that could be a huge amount of volume moved just between companies that you never know. Meanwhile, I think from the consumer use case, to your point, Steve, it's got to be things that you're either outside of the system or outside of the United States, or you need to use, a currency that just can't be, or a payment system that can't be supported in the old world. Nostr apps to me is the canonical obvious example of this, where Stacker News apps. And we still see, I forget what they, you can look on Nostr.bn stats. I think it's stalled a bit, but we still have seen, hundreds of thousands or more zaps, just for very small amounts. I think that'll keep growing.
Yeah, another thing I often hear, which I always find frustrating, is that a lot of Bitcoiners will say, no one's going to spend their Bitcoin now because they think the number is going to go up, right? And I think that's just like a really elementary take on things. So, because even if you think the number is going to go up a lot and you have an investment in Bitcoin, you don't have to touch that investment to spend Bitcoin. You can have another account. You can have another mental account in your head of this Bitcoin can be used for spending. And let's say you and it's going to be a tiny percentage of the Bitcoin in your investment. Let's say you have $50,000 you've invested in Bitcoin. Great. Don't touch that. You think it's going to go to half a million? Awesome. Don't touch it. You can have $100 of Bitcoin separate from that to zap people on Stacker News or Nostr. So it just doesn't hold water, this notion of people don't want to spend their Bitcoin because the number goes up. What matters is that there's a compelling reason to spend Bitcoin. And obviously, the more compelling the reason, and also another thing that really matters is like how what's the user experience like to have a software to spend Bitcoin? So if you have the more compelling the reasons, the easier it is to use. Absolutely, we're going to see an increase in payments over time. Another fallacy that I see is like this notion of, well, I already mentioned sort of the waterfall that like all the store of value has adoption has to go first, then payments. That's a fallacy. It's going to like immediately fast forward to like everything, all payments are done in Bitcoin. You know, the Starbucks coffee, the sushi, pizza, just every expense will be Bitcoin. No, it doesn't have to go to 0 to 100. And in fact, maybe we'll never see traditional payments that we're used to making in our lives be done with Bitcoin. Maybe we'll never see that. However, and I know a subject that Max will want to talk about is AI agents, AI to AI payments, but there could be all kinds of future payments that, and just micro payments could become popular. There could be all kinds of new future payments that didn't exist before. There was no market, and Bitcoin meets that a need in a unique way. So it gets used because it's the only solution. And we are never buying hamburgers or coffee with Bitcoin. But that doesn't mean that there's not trillions of dollars per year of payment volume in Bitcoin that's not possible.
Yeah, like most of our lives are moving onto the internet and into digital spaces, you know, whether you like it or not, whether it's the news you read or meeting people to even to meet in physical space, you end up meeting them initially online. So basically like every factor of your life is moving to digital, but we don't yet have the merchants even that are always going to be the final payment, kind of destinations. So I think like as, you know, as somebody builds a metaverse or some sort of augmented reality thing, those are going to need payments, and it's not going to be necessarily competing with Starbucks or hamburgers. There's going to be like native experiences that, you know, our lives are going to continue to get more natively digital. And so we need a native digital payment experience for that. I was wondering though, Steve, you had mentioned, I think last week when I'm getting bombed with some music now, can you hear Bob Marley in the background?
Yeah, this could be our theme song. We've just discovered our theme song. We didn't have to put it in
Was
any
that
work.
me, DK? I don't know. Oh, Steven, DK. I actually was like, it kind of turned off my Spotify.
We were talking about, yeah. So I think last week we were talking about different ways to generate yield if you hold a lot of Bitcoin, kind of related to the MicroStrategy discussion. And I think one of the things that Steve alluded to, and then maybe shared a tweet later in the week, is like if you had a big, you know, you sort of function as a big Lightning router, that's like one way to earn yield. And my question around this is I don't know enough about where the bottlenecks or constraints are, but is there like how much Bitcoin could you apply to like unstuck whatever's stuck in Lightning routing today? Like how can you apply like 10 Bitcoin, 100, 1,000? Like what's the order of magnitude that would actually help? And is the network, is that like a primary bottleneck today, or is it more like use cases need to emerge and then that becomes a possibility?
Yeah, it's yeah. And to your first question, yes and no, but mostly no. I mean, the last I looked, there's something like 5,000 Bitcoin of liquidity in announced nodes or nodes that are public, and that number is like relatively flattish for the last few years. So if you just look at that metric, you might think, "Eh, this is not an interesting network. There's not growth." And so a few comments on that though. Yeah, let's say that just increased 10x or 100x. We would not see an extra 100x increase in payment volume. So in other words, that is not a bottleneck today. In fact, River multiple times has reduced the amount of capacity on their Lightning nodes. And people freak out about that. They're like, they're getting out of the business, or business is bad, or growth is like it's decelerating. That's never the case. They're just becoming more efficient. So they're making more efficient use of that capital. So the way that the Lightning network works, if I want to pay David and I have to be routed through other nodes to get to David, it's all about finding a path with enough liquidity through the path to get to David. And so we're learning over time that operators of the network are learning over time how to become more efficient. I think so in large part, no, if Microsoft or MicroStrategy or whomever dumps a ton of capital into the Lightning network, that's not going to really move a needle. Obviously, over time, as we see natural growth, we need more liquidity for sure. So it's a necessary component. It's not a bottleneck. Where I'd say there is a bottleneck, though, is inbound liquidity to self-custody wallets and like in mobile wallets. There's not that many providers of that. There are a handful of upstarts, but there's no major companies or major amount of liquidity for that. I think that's just a sign of we're at early stages, but that's where I'd love to see like more startup potential and more startups and more small businesses can enter.
And what does that look like? Are those like new wallet types, like wallets that do that kind of liquidity management for you, or is it something else?
They don't. It can come in the form of a wallet provider. There are some wallet providers who are also building that liquidity aspect. Other wallet providers are looking to others to provide that for them. And then there are startups that are just focused on the liquidity part. That's their business. You can sort of mix and match that. We need more of all of that. But it all does tie back to the other point that we've made, which is the biggest driver of all this is I mean to me, the two biggest drivers, one is use cases, just value, compellingness. And then two is usability. But even compellingness out trumps of usability, because like people use crappy interfaces if it's really valuable to them. So some of these use cases, like if you want to buy medicine from Mexico or across the border or something, which is maybe illegal, maybe not, or maybe it's legal, but like a payment, traditional payment processors, it's against their policy. Or like if you're buying marijuana or something and it's legal in your state, but it's illegal federally or what, there's a lot of this gray area stuff. You're willing to jump through hoops and hurdles or gambling or porn, or there's all these different segments. You're willing to jump through hurdles. So it's all about the compellingness. But obviously the easier things are to use, you're just going to, you're going to have less friction, less drop off, more people using it as well. Those are the big drivers. Another thing we haven't talked about is like taxes. And so at least I don't know where it is, what the rules are around the world, but certainly in the US, if you buy a coffee, you are supposed to pay taxes on the capital gains or losses for that sale. And it's obviously like completely onerous to like track all that. It's not something that is going to be mainstream. So there needs to be tax reform around that, that, and there's been bills that have been in the early stages of being proposed by the House, I think, where payments up to $600 or something would be exempt. Sort of like up to a certain threshold, it's treated as currency. And then beyond that threshold, it's treated as a commodity and an investment, and then would have capital gains applied. So that's necessary too for widespread adoption. And
is that kind of bill currently outstanding or being considered, or that's something that sort of was written?
I don't track it super closely, but I think it's like very, or like it's been drawn up, but it doesn't have like huge support. But with the new administration coming in, that might be, it might be on the table now. And it just makes sense for Americans. I mean, like the vast majority, I mean, let's say that some compelling uses come about for Americans that are they're legal, they're, not criminal, and like they're completely ethical use cases. But Americans don't want to feel like a criminal when they're making a payment, and like making a $10 payment and having to like calculate taxes on that. Capital gains taxes seems bizarre. So anyway, that's yet another inhibitor to this that would need to be resolved for us to see widespread growth. But I don't think it limits a lot of these gray area use cases because people do it anyway.
I want to second a couple of things. One is the need for actual use cases. Like in my mind, the liquidity, as you said, is absolutely fine. It's keeping you more and more efficient. But there's just not enough people building things in my mind that actually use like today that are unique, right? So I agree with you. The AI thing is going to be huge. Today, the only company really pushing that is Jordy now with Feedbacks, and published a beautiful paper, I think 2 days ago, talking about, hey, by having native internet payments for our AIs, we can build new kinds of market intelligence that couldn't before. But I think one thing that is important is Jordy is someone unique, kind of like us in a way, that can speak between two different worlds. I actually think there's just a huge opportunity for translation to get good builders into the Lightning Network. One of the challenges that I face when I talk with mainstream Silicon Valley types or investors, or certainly the crypto investors, is they come to me and they say, cool, this Lightning Network thing. In fact, at a blockchain at Berkeley dinner, I think 2 years ago, all of the kids there said, Lightning sounds cool, but it's dead, right? No one had any idea that any of this activity is happening or that it's even possible to build on Lightning today. They just don't know. And I think part of it is an education problem. If you get more people in running more experiments with payments online, of course, more things are going to work, right? A wider top of the funnel. So I think one thing that actually be very valuable if someone is listening to this jam today and wants to be really constructive would be to build sort of a Lightning Network data site. Now, I know there's explorers. Mempool is a good one. 1ML has one. Amboss has one. But those explorers are very limited because all they basically show is liquidity has been flat for 2 years and channel count has gone down. If there is nowhere out there in the public, the references, Steve, that you're making since the River Report of Lightning Network use is growing. So I think one thing that could be very cool is to just build a simple site that brings in adoption numbers. One adoption number that you can use that I pulled right now that I want to mention is from Nostr.ban on Nostr Stats. I was even surprised with this. As of December, let's see, what day was this? 5th, maybe? What is it today? 6th? We saw on December 5th, yesterday, 10,602 zaps on Nostr. That's a lot. And in fact, that's a high, at least in recent months, probably because of Bitcoin hitting 100K, but the zaps were slinging. And if you look at the amount that was getting zapped there in that same time period, the daily zap amount was pretty high. We're at 2.5 million Satoshis. So that's like, those are real numbers. And that's not a total outlier. In fact, on November 12th, we had almost 4 million Satoshis getting zapped around. So these are real numbers, but no one has any idea that that's even happening. So one site that even just brings in, here's the amount of zaps happening on Nostr. Here's the amount of volume moving on Nostr. Here's what's, you know, coming from other private companies that are willing to establish an open data source. Like imagine if Keon, you know, he open sources a lot. What if he was saying, hey, here's the total GDP of Stacker News. Here's the total GDP of Nostr. River, I don't know what they would be willing to share or not. Albi, there's a lot of data they may be willing to share, a lot of these open source focused companies. And if someone wants to tackle this, you know, I'm happy to potentially make some of these intros. Like, I think just a site that says lightning is not dead.lol and shows everything booming is going to get so many people interested to come and build experiences.
I 100% agree with you that it's not reported today. Where it is reported, it's poorly framed. So 100% agree with what you said. I'll follow up with River to see if they're working on like a V2 of their report.
Amazing.
And then also we can get a sense from them too, whether it's realistic. You know, they collect a lot of the data. Is it realistic to do that in real time?
Fuck yeah.
You know, and then put it in a dashboard. To
PDJ or... Well, I'm making a breakthrough.
Also, like with private company data sources that I'm aware of, you know, I'll just check in with them too to see their interest level in publishing it. Because I think it's in self-interest to do so. Because I mean, anyone working on Lightning, seeing the growth, they want the growth of the Lightning Network to occur. And since there is this quite negative narrative, there's multiple negative narratives. People in crypto, but not Bitcoin, literally, they wrote Lightning off 7 years ago.
Like, I know, it's crazy.
They're like negative FUD and analysis on it like 7 years ago, and they've never looked at it again. And so they're just like completely oblivious to anything about Lightning. Then within the Bitcoin community, there's a large segment of people who think Lightning is dead or have written it off as well. And I think in that case, it's more about both impatience and misset expectations. So if you had expectations of 1 billion people using a self-custody, fully self-sovereign mobile wallet doing zero fee Lightning payments today, obviously you're disappointed and it hasn't been achieved. And with what we know, you might call it dead because maybe that's not achieved, what I just said, right? But that doesn't mean Lightning technology is dead or that Lightning enabling payments is dead. And obviously if we have data indicating the complete opposite, that it's growing quite well. So there, I think it's just misset expectations. Also, a lot of the people in that camp are promoting an alternative. So they have self-interest in promoting an alternative. So it's just natural to shit on the thing that they want to replace. But one thing that is very, very clear is that Lightning has won and has product market fit at being the glue between every other system that's handling payments within Bitcoin. And it already, name every other scaling technology, it already supports Lightning. You know, whether it's Fediment, Cashew, Arc, Spark, all these state chains, all these different things. Cash App, Coinbase, etc. Bitfinex, they all support Lightning. So all these systems that aren't compatible with each other, other than that they facilitate Bitcoin transactions, what's the lingua franca between them all? It's Lightning. So Lightning is one there. There's no doubt about it. The only questions about Lightning is like, how far can we push it to the individual level and giving them self-sovereignty? And that is an open research question. We're not sure exactly how far it can be pushed. But in terms of it being an enabler of payments on Bitcoin, there's no question.
And I mean, while we're kind of like breaking new ground and making sort of requests here, my dream, so I imagine if we could get some of this data out there from these private companies and the open source companies or rather protocol stuff like Nostr, that's all public data. So if someone's listening and you don't have anyone else that's going to give you data yet, you can go to Nostr and get started. At least with Nostr.band, maybe Primoz is open as well. The thing that I would love to see is for some data visualization guru to come out here and just make this thing beautiful, like Stacker News level beautiful. And what I would like to be able to do is put this into terms that normal people can understand. Our mutual friend Pablo F07Z over on Nostr, he always talks about in terms of what is the GDP of Nostr. And that is it's so simple. It's like, what's the GDP of the internet, right? That's like Stripe's whole thing. Like we empower and grow the GDP of the internet. Well, we got news for you, Stripe. If we're right, we're going to grow the GDP of the internet a whole lot more with all that we can enable. So if you could literally go through and say, what's the GDP of Nostr? what's the GDP of Stacker News? What's the GDP of these few sats AI agents? And literally be able to like sort the data, have a beautiful visualization. What's the GDP of Lightning overall versus the GDP of the internet? Are those two things moving? I think you would get so much interest from so many people. Then the next step is you have to show them it's easy. Then you can send them to something like Nostr Wallet Connect or all these beautiful, easy to use packages that are ready to start developing. But I think the first battle that we have to win is just showing people GDP, large, growing.
I'm a fan of all of that. I love more visualizations, more aggregation of data. I think those can be helpful. I wonder if there's another thing though, and I'm not sure exactly what it is, but there's sort of like a brand or perception issue that like Bitcoin is like somehow stodgy and old and, you know, not willing to have technology kind of building associated with it, that it's more like a anti-builder. Maybe I think it has that perception, which is not necessarily the reality. And then I think a lot of these other, like, you know, Ethereum or Solana or other things always sort of have this story of like, hey, you can build on Solana, you can build on Ethereum. And so even though there hasn't been a lot that has actually been built like of substance on those types of protocols, I think they come forward with that proposition. And so I'd say there's at least two that are not built on those protocols, but that use those protocols for payments. And I think they're kind of, I'm not certain of this, but isn't, I think Kalshi and Polymarket are each, I think either ETH or Solana based, but they're not actually like applications. They're not decentralized applications. They're just like websites, centralized websites that make markets and that payments happen via these other chains that supposedly are like very developer friendly. So is there some truth to that? And if there is there any way to help kind of give the brand visibility of all the great stuff that you can do with payments, all the great new kind of tools that you can assemble to make payments great? And like, should the next Polymarket or Kalshi be built with like the internet's native currency?
There's a lot of questions packed into there. I mean, I think one observation I have is I think Bitcoin's really the only ecosystem focused on payments, actually. The other ecosystems are, payment with the native token. So like Solana, you could say, is focused on payments, but their solution is US dollar, like stable coins. And same with like Ethereum, there are layer twos on Ethereum where one of their objectives is stable coins. Like, for example, Coinbase has Base, a layer two on Ethereum, and they're definitely investing in and promoting USDC stablecoin on Base on Ethereum. So it's my impression for most cryptocurrency ecosystems, payments to them means US dollars. And I think there's no question there's like near-term interest and market fit for that. And it already has grown a lot, will continue to grow a lot. The numbers are way higher than Bitcoin payments on Lightning. And I think they'll continue that way for quite a bit of time. You know, for the foreseeable future, I think US dollar payments are, even in the form of stable coins, is going to be much larger in volume than Bitcoin payments. But that doesn't mean Bitcoin payments aren't interesting. But in terms of like using Solana, the token, as money and for payments, I don't think that's a thing. And I don't think it's a stated goal. Same with Ethereum. So I think Bitcoin's the only major cryptocurrency or project that actually focuses on Bitcoin as payments. The other ecosystems primarily focus on DeFi or other smart contract applications. And so that's another like comparison I've seen made, which I think is pretty misleading. Like if you look at the amount of Bitcoin wrapped in WBTC, wrapped Bitcoin, and there's other similar types of wrapping of Bitcoin, and just the amount of like Ethereum and other coin like liquidity tied up into DeFi, it is substantial. Especially like in 2021, and there's like massive volumes, and so people will compare that to Lightning, and Lightning is just like trivial in terms of volume. But they're just two completely different things. That they're just not measuring the same thing. One is all about just the gambling casino. You know, it's not a cynical take, I think, to say that like that was all speculative gambling casino. Now, it could be the case that the smart contract platforms in the long term turn out to facilitate really interesting, sustainable, societal, valuable use cases. But in the period so far that we've observed of it, it's all gambling. That's not what Bitcoin payments on Lightning are today. So it's just two completely different markets. So I think it's a kind of a nonsensical comparison when people make that comparison. So getting back to Max's point about creating like visuals and data and like trying to convince people, it's really important to frame it correctly as well and not compare apples to oranges.
And again, that's the importance of having data be transparent, right? Because the problem is it's easy to go in and say, well, Uniswap has this much TVL or total volume locked. And it's like, great, for to your point, for what? People can buy gambling tokens, which is fine. But like, whereas with Lightning, you're like, okay, we have 5,000 BTC locked up, but no idea how that money is being routed. Because if you think about it, right, like you can literally ping back and forth a Satoshi between two nodes at the speed of light. No one has any idea the actual payment volume. And like, again, we can get much closer by showing some of this. But until we can say, hey, it's for payments, it's not, it has nothing to do with TVL. These are really, really, in fact, as your point, Steve, I think this should be made as well. Lightning Network is meant to be capital efficient. So in theory, if it's doing well, we should be able to do, you know, one metric we should be trying to track is payment volume versus total amount locked up in Lightning Network. Hopefully over time, you can route more payment volume with a lot less Bitcoin. But anyways, I digress, and that comes back to having the data transparent. The other thing that I would say, though, once people have that piece of education, you know, to your point, Deacon, I do think there is a user or developer experience gap as well. We can be frustrated all we want with the shitcoins and blah, blah, blah. And yes, they may trade off centralizing, which makes it easier to use. But there's no question that like Solana is developer friendly. It's nice. It's easy. The docs look good. Something the Ethereum community, even when I, you know, was at a different fund that focused on that, frankly, they have infinitely better UI UX for users and for developers. They're just better. The developer experience is so much nicer. It's aesthetically pleasing. It looks like you're playing with Notion instead of the terminal, which is what Bitcoin feels like. And it's getting better, but that's the analogy that I would use. And so I think something that would be really, really nice in the Bitcoin community as well, this could come from a company, it could come from an open source project, could come from an individual contributor, perhaps someone from, you know, a Spiral grant one day, is just like a set of really easy to use kind of like courses, ideally on something like Replit, where the developers already are, that says, hey guys, this is going to be really beautiful, really easy to use. And in 1 hour, you're going to build your first app that sends a Lightning payment, done. And it's going to be fun. I don't know if I just dropped.
Whatever just happened, keep doing
Something.
that, because there's no background noise.
Yeah.
Okay. Something just happened. So anyhow,
Whatever just happened, but can I
yeah.
add to what you were just saying, Max? Totally agree on the dev UX, the user experience for developers. Yeah, I mean, David, you brought this up initially. So there is no question. Historically, Ethereum, Solana, these other ecosystems have better developer UX than Bitcoin. Number one, it's because Bitcoin didn't ICO, didn't raise VC money. There's no centralized organization or funding to prioritize building out a dev UX. So who's going to build the dev UX? There's no natural choice or obvious funding of that. So it's why Spiral is fortunate to get funding from Block to do whatever we want. And what did we choose to do? We're not building applications. We're not using our budget to work on things that like has a business model or venture capitalists would fund. We're funding really important projects that basically don't have a business model. So dev kits, SDKs are one, right? So we are focused on improving the developer user experience, and we're making really good strides. So we fund the Bitcoin Developer Kit, BDK, and the Lightning Developer Kit, LDK, are two examples of what we fund. And they both now have dozens of applications and wallets built on top of them now. In fact, I just learned today MetaMask is now using BDK, which is amazing. So Proton Wallet, MetaMask, BitKey from Block, major brands and huge user bases are now using these developer kits for Bitcoin. So the good news is it is getting better, but there was a big gap. There's been a big gap to close. That gap is closing. And if you look at like commercial providers like Lightspark, Breeze, SDK, there are commercial companies that are taking things like LDK, building on another layer on top of it to make it even better for application developers. So I think we'll continue to see that as well. So that gap is closing.
And I want to give another shout out. I just shared this in the chat. And you guys have obviously done incredible work on the actual itself. I still, though, want to see one like level down. I just sent out Nostr Wallet Connect, and Nostr Wallet Connect's nwc.dev. DK muted his mic. Okay. I think that was the key. NWC.dev, which Nostr Wallet Connect came out of Albi originally. Now it's open source projects, easy way to use Nostr relays to pass Lightning invoices around. That to me is like the example of what I want to see. It's super, super simple site. It's aesthetically pleasing. It looks modern. And like a JavaScript level developer could come in here and be like, oh, wow, with just a few lines of code, I could implement, maybe it's not perfectly non-custodial or whatever, but like I could get something working within under an hour. Like to me, that's the magic moment. I need to be able to be a dev, come to a simple, beautiful site and just build some crappy demo app, but like realize, wow, that was easy. And so NWC.dev is probably the best example I've seen of that so far. I would love to see something like this on Replit as well, where a lot of the developers are already living.
Couple more things to add to that. Just an example of the improvement within LDK. So prior to Lightning Development Kit, LDK existing, if you wanted to build a Lightning wallet on a mobile phone, and we have instances of this, like the Moon wallet, MUUN, they have like a large development team and they spent like 6 years developing their product from, and they've written like everything from scratch, and they're still not even done with the re-architecting. They're still not even released yet. And so like, it's just a, the barrier to entry for that is enormous. Then LDK came along, and LDK is a powerful developer kit with like 1,000 methods in the library. What we've observed, and anyone using it, it takes a couple developers a year, so like 2 developer years to get a product out in the market. So much better than the first instance, but still substantial. We then implemented what's called LDK Node, which is another layer on top of LDK. Now you can have a product in market with one developer in like a month. I mean, in a weekend, that developer can have a working prototype. And within a month or two, you can have a product that's launched. AllBeHub is the first adopter of this LDK node, and they had a much easier time developing than past users of LDK. And it's only going to get better. So I think that's a really good sign and good example. I forget the other point I was going to make. So we can. Oh, actually, no, I do. So Max, you're talking about like educational resources. So there is a Spiral grantee, his name's Austin. He's working on a programming Lightning workshop. So if anyone's familiar with Jimmy Song's Programming Bitcoin, it's a workshop that hits you hard. It's like drinking from the fire hose for a couple of days, but you really learn the basics of Bitcoin. And Austin's creating something similar for Lightning. So that's one example, but you know, Nifty Nay and others have a lot of educational boot camps and resources, Chain Code. So there are people doing good work there. What we need to see is better scale. Like there's high quality technical and developer educational material now and courses, but we haven't found a way to scale that beyond small groups.
And do you think that scale can come, like would some of these courses do better online, or does that sort of lose the intimacy of what makes them actually work?
Like a lot of the stuff is open source and is available online. So anyone able and willing to self-study can do so for free. I think the barrier is this stuff is complicated. So, you know, finding the, you know, being able to do it in isolation and finding the initiative to do it on your own is a pretty, so I don't exactly know the right recipe here. I know it is a need to figure out how to scale it. Another initiative that Spiral's helped fund and others have helped fund too is called Summer of Bitcoin, which I think Google had Summer of Code or something like that. Yeah. But it's an internship program for Bitcoin developers, which has been going on for 3 or 4 years now. And it's had, you know, decent success. Tons of people have done it, and it has resulted in people landing young people in their just finishing up university, landing full-time jobs in Bitcoin or becoming regular contributors to open source projects. So I think that's another example of something that's positive, but lots of small positive things that we need to figure out how to scale. I think one thing that's promising is once we see large tech companies realize the value of Bitcoin that they need to start engaging, hopefully people copy what Jack Dorsey's done at Block and created Spiral 5 years ago. And you know, that's what I work on and lead. It's been one of my disappointments in my role is that I have not been able to get any other tech company to do that. I still have that as a goal though. So hopefully it happens, but I'd love to see Stripe, Google, Facebook, et cetera, create Spiral-like organizations. And when they do, and when they want more of their developer teams to learn Bitcoin, there's going to be massive demand for technical education on Bitcoin. And that's where I think maybe we can get some scale.
And one more thing, I would really like to work on with what you're saying, because I agree with all of that, and we do need better scale with our educational resources, and there are really good ones out there. But one thing that I've come to realize, and it's very simple and very basic, and I know, Steve, you have actually done quite a lot to promote this with the Bitcoin design community, But frankly, I think the number one thing that I would like to see from some of these educational resources is just really modern, beautiful, better design. I know it sounds silly and very basic, but like, I cannot say how, like, honestly, I think at this stage, having a really, really top, like, senior Notion level designer coming and building a Bitcoin, like, hey, in a weekend, you're going to start building your first Lightning apps, like in Nostr apps, I think that would do more to unlock developer activity than anything else. And there are a couple of those people in the space, Mayank at Umbral, like they do really high quality design stuff. I would argue, I think, you know, Stacker News and Albi are kind of close to that, but the vast majority, you know, especially outside of companies, but on the educational side, like if you are a killer designer and maybe you're not as deep in the code, you could make an incredible impact here by making these tutorials beautiful.
100% agree. And for any designers listening who want to get involved in Bitcoin, bitcoin.design is the Bitcoin design community that was formed four and a half years ago. It's a great resource, great community. They've done many good things for Bitcoin, but I still feel like the vast majority of value that is going to bring to Bitcoin is ahead of us. So would love to see more super high quality designers get engaged and involved with that.
So I know I mentioned this piece that I had written about Sailor, and I will publish it at some point. But I think to me, it feels like one of the things I would like to write is to answer some of the questions that we're asking right here, which is like, Steve, you said you'd like to inspire other organizations to have a spiral-like thing. But I think to do that well, I think it almost would help to be a little more prescriptive about what that might look like. Not to say exactly what it needs to be, but just like, here's some ideas. And is it like, if let's say that Sailor wanted to do this, right? What would be like the best thing for them to do? I assume it's not another spiral equivalent, this open source, you know, kind of development toolkits, if that's a reasonable framing of what spiral is today, you know, the grants and stuff to open source stuff. Would you encourage them to do like their own efforts that maybe are towards commercializing projects or a startup incubator or some other kind of, you know, structure? Or do you like, how do you imagine, like, let's say we were to try to, you know, get Sailor enthusiastic about why he should create a spiral-like organization. What kinds of feature, what kinds of activities would they do?
Yeah, I think, well, let's piggyback off of what we talked about in the last conversation we had, which is a way that MicroStrategy could earn yield on the Bitcoin that they hold is by deploying it on the Lightning Network, and they can earn yield. Well, that suggests to me that they should proactively engage on Lightning Network technology, right? And I'd say sort of the full stack, meaning I think it makes sense for them to hire super high quality protocol engineers who work on the Lightning protocol itself and Lightning implementations. I'm biased. I would suggest they work on LDK. LDK is intended to be the world's Lightning implementation. So, you know, they could hire developers and work on LDK. They can take, and not just hire developers to work on LDK, but like become meaningful contributors to LDK. Right now, the maintainers of LDK are Spiral employees. We want non-Spiral employees to be maintainers of LDK. So we'd love to see the MicroStrategies of the world engage and contribute so much that they earn the right to be maintainers. We want that. And they have even more say in the roadmap of LDK. So that's one example. They could also build out Lightning infrastructure. We talked earlier in the episode about liquidity providers. So they could build out, and of course, if they want to make money off of Lightning, they need to be a liquidity provider. So they can run sort of standard fare forwarding nodes, like the routing Lightning nodes that are sort of the core of the Lightning network, but they can also be on the edge of the network. That are the nodes talking directly to wallets and clients, whether it be mobile, web, Nostr, whatever. They can be on the edge. And you can make money at both the edge and the inner core of the network. So they should be building products for both of those. And this is not, it's not as simple as just, I mean, it can be as simple as just taking LND or Lightning implementation and just running it. However, if you want to build a real business around this, it is much more than just like running a binary software like that. You need to build out a lot of tooling around it, scaling, performance, automation, all kinds of different things. So they could invest in that as well.
I'd like to take that question, DK, maybe in a slightly different direction. I mean, I think that would be awesome, and maybe one day we'll get Saylor there. I wouldn't expect it short term, given the way he seems to be excited about using Bitcoin as just store of value. But one thing I would like to give a shout out to Saylor for, which I think maybe also transitions us a little bit into another topic we had on the list, is, you know, I think as people start giving and contributing open source, maybe best to kind of meet them where they are today and what makes most sense with their worldview. So I don't know if you guys played with this, but I know we were talking a little bit about the Michael Saylor's presentation to Microsoft, where he was trying to orange pill them and get them to go somewhere between have some Bitcoin and triple maxi. I was like listening to that presentation. I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about that. And I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was excellent. Very well done. Super concise, 3.5 minutes. I mean, Saylor killed it. He's gotten really good at getting the distilling the core messages. But I noticed at the end of that, he says, hey, we have an open source model where you can go through and play with all of these scenarios yourself, triple maxing, all this stuff. And I was like, what the hell is a triple maxi? So I did download the model. Interestingly, it's open source, but it's just an Excel sheet. It's literally just an Excel sheet with a bunch of macros, which it sounds like compared to all the stuff that we're talking about, that's very complex and very cutting edge and all this stuff. Like it sounds like, okay, some dude made an Excel sheet and like put it on GitHub, which true. But on the other hand, like that maybe will move the world at least short term in more ways than any other open source contribution. Why? Because all the Excel jocks and CFOs or whatever the world, they all use Excel. It's where they are today. It's kind of like we talked about last time when Pierre, you know, built the Lightning Network integrations for the Excel people. And I started playing a little bit with some of this and some of the assumptions. And you're like, holy shit, like you can literally see for any company, you know, if you go on all of their different scenarios. And it's interesting, like he also, I think, you know, kind of takes a really good sort of negotiation tactic, which perhaps Trump has been accused of using as well, which is, you know, he builds in there all these scenarios you can play with, like, oh man, you can go what he calls triple maxi, put all of your reserves in, you know, do equity issuances to buy Bitcoin and do the debt, you know, convertible debt offerings and, you know, walks you through all that. Or you can do just the simple, which is, you know, just to put 10-20% of your treasury into Bitcoin, which I know, Steve, you've been talking about as more of the block strategy versus the MicroStrategy. Anyways, my broader point there is, even though that's just a simple model, they also have a lot of videos walking you through it. I thought that was extremely valuable. I think that model and just like the education around it could potentially change the world over the next year as more companies, they also have nation states, institutions all have tabs on there. And so maybe one thing I would say, you know, to a Saylor is how can you take that and supercharge it? I don't know. Maybe it's as simple as starting like a Discord community for all of the like orange pilled CFOs and Excel jocks within every company. They can go like, hey, here's the problems I'm running up against. Like, how did you like get your people over the hoop? I don't know if they need additional software to do that. But if I were Saylor, I would be saying, what else can we open source? What tools, communities, resources can we do to find the one crazy, you know, hodler in every company and get them to get their company buying Bitcoin?
And while you're talking about the Microsoft pitch, I think that's, you know, we only have a few minutes left for the time. But I, you know, I took a quick listen to his 3 minute or so narration, and that, you know, to me it sounded reasonable, like well articulated, very condensed, reasonable. I didn't feel like I learned a lot of new stuff about his position or about Bitcoin or how it might fit in. But I think Steve mentioned that kind of he was going page by page with his friends on some other group chat, and it was like very controversial. There was like a lot of discussion about it. So I wonder, kind of in the vein of the kind of, I guess the setup to this is, my understanding is some activist shareholder who had a very small position in Microsoft was able to get this on the docket for the December 10th board meeting, which is Tuesday? And so they kind of like have to at least, you know, give it some sort of nod of viability for discussion. And then I think Saylor went and did something of an open presentation to the Microsoft board, but then I think he's later invited in to maybe even give 3 minutes at the meeting. So that's my understanding of at least what we've got right now. But what are the sort of controversial points, Steve, that you were raising on it?
I don't recall saying it was controversial, but
okay. I thought there was not that the points were controversial, but
I think it's all. I agree, it's straightforward, but I mean. The reason it took me more than 3 minutes to listen to it is because I had to pause each slide. I mean, he covered like 40, 50 slides or something in 3 minutes. So I paused to like just digest what was being said. I agree with, I think, all of it. And it is a super dense 3 minute presentation. One thing that was stated, though, that I would love to see more analysis on is the slide relatively early on. It's at 19 seconds. And it says, out of the $900 trillion of wealth in the world, 450 trillion is long-term capital store of value, and the other 450 trillion is in assets held for utility. I want to see the analysis of that. And I say that not because I disbelieve it. I just want to see more credibility behind it. I forget if we talked about this last show or not. In fact, Max, you mentioned that open source model they had. I poked around at that as well, hoping it had the analysis, but I didn't see it. So either I missed it or it's not there yet, but it belongs in that open source project they've done to demonstrate what percentage of real estate is store value versus utility. So what? Let's see. In their slide presentation, they say 330 trillion in real estate. I've seen estimates as high as 500 or 600 trillion in real estate, but I mean, whatever. It's either one. It's enormous, right? What percentage of that is based on rental income and cash flows, and what percentage is the monetary premium of that asset? Same with stocks, same with bonds, all these big asset classes. There's no doubt in my mind, some percentage of that 900 trillion is store of value, like way beyond gold. That makes gold tiny, but I just don't know if it's 1%, 10%, or what they're claiming, 50%. And it almost doesn't matter what the number is because it's really big. And I mean, Bitcoin has a huge TAM, but I think with proper analysis, it'll lend credibility so that, because most people don't think of it this way, I don't think, and they wouldn't believe it just by watching a 3-minute Michael Saylor presentation. They'd think it's smoke and mirrors or nonsense. But if there's like really good analysis behind it, I think it'll persuade people to see there's tens of trillions and maybe hundreds of trillions of value that is purely store value and doesn't have a cash flow analysis behind it. Because something people get tripped up on with valuing Bitcoin is like, once they get to a point where like, okay, I do see value in Bitcoin, but how do you value it? How do you know the price? How do you know the number's gonna go up? Well, if you do, if there's a credible answer to like, well, there's $450 trillion of store value that doesn't have cash flow analysis backing it, then why can't Bitcoin eat all of that?
Yeah, I think it's the part that's often missed is that there's reflexivity in all of pricing. And so, you know, if you were to actually move the store of value portion, let's say it was 50%, if you were to remove the 50% store of value in real estate out of real estate, the actual value of real estate would be different and the rental kind of costs or prices would be different. And so the cash flow would be different. And so sort of you sort of pull out this really important piece and kind of the whole thing has to restructure around that idea, which I would love to see a good analysis. I'm just saying, I think one of the reasons we might not have it is that it's just a, because it's so reflexive, there's no real perfect answer to it. One thing that I think could help people get over the cash flow question is if you were to look at recent year CAGRs, so compounded annual growth rates, look at recent years, not of what it's been, you know, 40% annual or 50% annual or something. And if you were to say like, take a conservative approach, assume that's going to decrease over time, it may or may not, but like assume it, you know, was 50% and it's going to be 40% and then 30%, like decrease the CAGR and look at how much you could sell off to maintain a position so that you can have like this non-revenue producing asset that you can turn into kind of a cash flowing asset in that sense.
And I mean, I think it's clear there's two things. One, there is no answer, but to your point, this should be the open source piece, right? Like I could see that, hey, maybe this turns into a slide by slide presentation on Stacker News and like let people hash it out and debate and like let people, you know, compete with their own supplementary analyses and like, you know, whatever, people can choose whichever one they want to use. But I love that idea. And I think Saylor, or if you or someone at MicroStrategy happens to listen to this, like, yeah, the more open source analysis for each of those numbers, the more likely we are to get more companies to adopt. So I think that's awesome. This also just reminds me, it's a bit of an aside, but just an idea, a request for proposal I would love to put out there since, you know, we have so many listeners on this pod right now, but one challenge in the world is it's tricky to get real data on things, on many, many things. And so one use case that I would have for the Lightning Network, in addition to incentivizing having people bet on things with prediction markets and upvoting with cash and what they think is the actual right answer, which is powerful, and we'll see that primitive used, but is also like a real-time crowdsourcing platform for data. Like one thing that I've always wanted to see, and I'm shocked this hasn't been built yet, is like, okay, I'm seeing inflation numbers reported up from Argentina. How the fuck do I know if that's real or not? I have no clue. I'm taking some centralized word, party's word for it. And for all I know, in fact, I assume it's a lie. Or even if they're not lying, they just don't have the ability to collect the data.
So, yeah, they're never unbiased.
They're never unbiased. And even if they are unbiased, like, how do I know they're competent? So one thing that I would love to see one day is a platform that makes it super easy to essentially pay people in real time with micropayments, final settlement, ideally, to collect data. And so I would love to know, like, okay, what is the actual cost of a gallon of gasoline in Argentina today on December 6, 2024? That's an answerable question.
Cool. I know we've run through our time already and we don't have all the answers. There was one thing on the Treasury piece that I think Steve had some commentary on. How I think we touched on this last time, but how kind of MicroStrategy and Square are sort of two different Treasury strategies. And I thought that it was a little off for MicroStrategy to be pitching the MicroStrategy Treasury strategy to Microsoft, compared to, like, really the Square strategy is probably more appropriate for Microsoft to hear. And I wonder, like, is that a fair assessment, or do you think actually MicroStrategy is the right story? And is there a Square or somebody else who's putting together the, like, actual Bitcoin treasury, you know, the convincing, you know, operating company, profitable, good revenue sources outside of being a Bitcoin treasury company? Is there anybody who's like Block or somebody else who's working on kind of building the story that would make most sense to somebody like Microsoft?
Yeah, I mean, I think the MicroStrategy strategy to me is like a winner take all, or only a few can do it. And for MicroStrategy to do it is genius. It's a great play. Love seeing it unfold. I just don't see how everyone can do it, though. Not every company in the world, whether you're a large tech company or even like a small and medium-sized business, you're not going to hire a sales force and go sell like to bondholders and equity holders. It just doesn't make any sense, let alone the risk that you want to take on, let alone is there the capacity for thousands of these types of plays. So that makes no sense at all to me. Whereas the Block Bitcoin treasury strategy is one that I think is applicable to any business, and that's just putting a small portion of your treasury in Bitcoin, like 1% or 5% or, 10%, depending on your situation, conviction, et cetera, but a bunch of variables would be an appropriate amount. But a small portion of your treasury, put it in Bitcoin, probably do it over time, like take a percentage of sales and put it in Bitcoin. In fact, Square even has a product for that. It's called Conversions. That's for Square merchants. They can just click a button in their UI and convert a percentage of their sales to Bitcoin and put it in their treasury. So that is applicable to all companies. And I think, you can certainly conclude that that's a sensible choice. It's not like a risk on choice. I mean, there's still a lot of people who would, even if putting 1% of your treasury in Bitcoin, would consider risky. I think we're maturing to a point where a lot more people don't see that as risk on, but actually super prudent in reducing risk by putting a small portion of your treasury in Bitcoin. So yeah. Also, I think because MicroStrategy strategy is so audacious and bold and ambitious, combined with Michael Saylor is like 12 hours a day in everyone's faces talking about it, which he should be, and he's doing a really good job. Because of that, no one even knows really that Block was first out of the gates doing this. Saylor announced MicroStrategy's treasury play in August 2020, and Block had been working on a Bitcoin treasury strategy for like the prior year and launched it like a few weeks after Saylor. So it was a little unfortunate to be beaten at the gun there. But and then September 2020, Block produced a white paper with a playbook of how corporations could convert a portion of their treasury. But because it's less ambitious and because Block really hasn't given it turned the volume up on it anywhere remotely to the degree that Saylor has, few people even are aware of that. But I think realistically, that is the play that most companies should be considering.
And what's the link that you shared? Because I think this past week, I discovered some tweet that somebody was saying that I think Coinbase has 12.5% of their treasury in Bitcoin. And then I think you shared, like, you're like, oh, that was obvious. That's been known for a long time. Here's the list. And there was a list of every, you know, top 100 companies that have Bitcoin on their treasury?
BitcoinTreasuries.net.
Okay. Oh, they got the .net. Good.
I think NVK had like BitcoinTreasuries.com and created that site, and then he sold it to someone and then just created BitcoinTreasuries.net and has the site.
There's a guy, shout out NVK. That guy's always got crazy ideas and just does them and ships cool stuff. One thing that I would like to add to that is because I remember, and you guys did a great job with this when you all put that like corporate adoption. You even had the B Word conference where you interviewed Elon, which is pretty badass and a lot of stuff. So yeah, I mean, I think maybe part of that, you know, it would be awesome to see Block push that a lot more because you've already got the content. It's great. And I do think for more people, that's more realistic. I do just kind of want to circle back though on two things. One, what I was saying before in that MicroStrategy, I think it's genius the way he's playing this because in his presentations, you know, by being so audacious and over the top, he makes the Block strategy look just like, oh, that's the conservative thing. Like there's nothing crazy about that, which is great. And that is playing on human psychology. Like props to Saylor. Like you go through this model and you're like, I think it is the right choice to go in there. And I love the way he has it. I forgot what he calls the first one, but like maxi, double maxi, triple maxi, like, and it sounds like something Trump would do. And like, Trump is great at getting people, you know, to think crazy things are normal. So I think he's playing that super well. I think you absolutely go in and show them the scenarios of like, hey guys, if you start issuing your debt and selling your equity and all this stuff, oh yeah, but if you kind of want to do the, you know, the single max, just put 10% in Bitcoin. They're like, yeah, that's the conservative. So I think that kind of anchoring is excellent and it's going to bring a lot more people to the more realistic solution. But I just want to come back and say, I still stand by it. I know everyone thinks I'm crazy. I stand by it. I think we're going to see some major companies doing the triple maxi, issuing debt. You know, one thing I thought on a little bit since last time we talked is that, you know, yes, and DK, to your point, you'll probably see there's some reflexivity here, which is true. But I do just want to, you know, reiterate, I do think it's possible to kind of like value different business units separately. Yes, if you start doing this crazy stuff, maybe that detracts from your other business models. But even with MicroStrategy, I know it's very, very small, but I saw like an announcement when I was Googling them for the latest news. So I'm just curious what craziness they're putting out there. They announced a new business intelligence deal. They just sounds like, well, yeah, I forgot they had this like business intelligence business that like, you know, it's somewhere in there. And like, they're still, apparently there are people that still do that at the company. So just to be clear, I think that I know it sounds crazy and it's a very small portion of their revenue or their whatever, a business relative to Bitcoin holdings, but it's still growing. And I do think we're going to see people eventually take the triple maxi and from some big companies. So
You've seen that XKCD comic with the little, you know, the little open source project that is being kind of all of the rest of the scaffolding of the whole internet is held up by like one part-time contributor. That's what I think applies here. Yeah.
There's a chance, I'm telling you.
Well, we did another thing that we laughed at Max about last time, and he was correct, is that, what was that? We looked it up.
Brian Romelli.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brian Romelli takes tips in Bitcoin.
Oh, right. Yeah, he takes tips on X. Yeah. So there you go. I'm not going to laugh at Max ever.
Don't laugh at Max. And then when you open up Instagram next time and click pull to refresh and there's nothing there, you'll know it's because they abandoned content, social media strategy and advertising business.
They're all in.
They went all in. Oh, no. But what I was saying is it's those people at MicroStrategy who work on the business intelligence software. Those are the guys that running the little open source. Sorry, yeah, I didn't finish the analogy, but that's where I was going with that.
That's gotta be interesting. If you're like the sales guy at MicroStrategy, but you're selling the business intelligence product, that's gotta be interesting.
You're like holding the whole thing up by like, you know what, $50 million in net revenue.
And imagine going to me, you're like, guys, we have this awesome AI, like AI. We'll talk Bitcoin, man.
All right. Well, we're way over, so I'm gonna call this a wrap. We got through 5 or 10% of what we intended to, so I guess we'll have to come back next week and do it again.
Sounds good.
All right.
See you guys.
See ya.
Peace.
And actually